back together again, you and I, in a midweek Wednesday, February 1st, 2023 edition of Connecticut Today. We highlighted a controversial motorcycle helmet law being proposed at the state capitol. Yankee Institute President Carol Platt Leibow weighed in on a proposal for the expanded use of traffic cameras around the state. And we were also joined by Jean-Paul Mac Isaac, author of American Injustice, My Battle to Expose the Truth.
Ah, you people that ride motorcycles, you're going to love this one. This is one of these things that I read, honestly. And, you know, sometimes, especially in a day and age like we are right now, what is this, on Wednesday, the 1st of February, 2023, right, 2/1/2023, you know, you read this stuff and you say to yourself, is this real or is it satire, right? You sit back and you say, well, wait a minute, geez, I have to read this 1, 2, 3, 4 times to say to yourself, well, wait a minute. Hold on here. Is this some really skillfully good, finely honed, finely crafted satire? Or is this really happening? Because the crazy times that we live in now, it's getting tough to tell the difference. What am I talking about today? And every day we seem to come on and I'm able to scour all the news sites here in Connecticut. Part of my job is to let you know about the lunacy in Hartford, which pretty much comes from one party. It comes from the Democratic Party in Hartford. They suggest things, they push things that result in higher taxes, that result in higher business operating expenses, that result in some of your personal liberties getting taken away, while we have people that can't pay their energy bills in this state, while we now have an outflow of people leaving this state because it's so expensive, while we have an outflow of seniors leaving the state because it's really expensive. So instead of, you know, addressing things like that, dollar and cents issues, the majority Democrats in Hartford, and if you don't believe me, folks, if you think I'm being too partisan, fine. At this point in my career, I couldn't care less what some of these people think. They'll listen to me. Bottom line is, though, I'm just calling it as I see it. And the whole social engineering thing here, get this. You people who own a motorcycle or you ride, get this. And I swear to you, I've checked. This does not look like it's satire. It's real. Connecticut State Senate President Pro Tem Martin Looney. What a surprise. I mean, there's a guy who wakes up in the morning and he can get reelected. He is completely out of touch with most of Connecticut. But usually, as many of the legislative leaders are in Hartford, they are out of touch. And I'm just reading this. This is out of, CycleNews.com. And this is courtesy. It was posted and sniffed out by our buddy, our pal Tom Dudchick at the Connecticut Report, CTCapitalReport.com. Tom, good job on you and your copious staff there. Martin Looney has introduced a bill, SB 96. Now, again, a lot of these bills, because some of them are so crazy, they go nowhere. They go nowhere. But this is, I think, more of a middle finger from Senator Looney than anything that could practically pass. But just the fact that he introduced this to, and I've known Marty for years. I haven't spoken to him in a long time, but again, you know, sometimes you just become a caricature of yourself. And I even have, look, I'll tell you, I have Democratic friends of mine who have, you know, asked my opinion about helping out with legislative issues. And, you know, they say, well, geez, I contacted so-and-so and so-and-so in New Haven and there's no response. I tell them, well, what did you expect? When these people are in office for life, what did you expect? I tell them. State Senate President Pro Tem Martin Looney has introduced a bill, SB, Senate Bill 96, that would, now get this, if you ride a motorcycle, get this, you talk about the middle finger, you talk about the bird from a very high-ranking member of the governance of Connecticut. that would automatically assume any motorcyclist killed on the road is an organ donor if they were riding without a helmet. So that's a middle finger from one of the top legislative leaders in the state here, not the country, thank God, but in the state here, saying that if you unfortunately are killed, or anybody you know is killed in a motorcycle accident, and you or anybody you know for whatever reason is not wearing a helmet, it's not mandatory in this state. I know people who have bikes, from everything from a little scooter to a full-fledged Harley. Some people wear helmets and some people don't. It's a personal thing. I've never ridden on a motorcycle. I frankly am not speaking from any body of knowledge on this. I have friends and relatives who say they wouldn't go anywhere without a helmet on, and I have friends and relatives who say they don't like it because it cuts down on their field of vision. They feel too claustrophobic wearing it. But according to Senator Looney here, according to this bill, the state, you talk about overreach? You people are worried about traffic cameras. You people had your gullions in an uproar yesterday because of traffic cameras. How about this one? It would automatically assume the state would, you talk about an overreach. The state would automatically assume that if you're killed on the road, if you're a motorcyclist and you're killed on the road and you're not wearing a helmet, you're automatically an organ donor. He can't be serious with this. So would that mean, as I'm reading it here, the state then would be able to just pick up your body like roadkill and say, well, the last the state police or the local police who respond to it was the guy or the gal on the motorcycle. Did they have a helmet on? Well, no, they did not. Okay, what do we need here? Well, let's take those livers. Let's take that liver. Kidney, here we go. Hey, who needs a kidney? All right, here, this one looks good. This is amazing. Corneas. Hey, I heard we needed corneas today. Let's get that right out of the right eye, left eye. I'm telling you, this is nuts. If this even goes to a committee hearing, this is bad. And I know people might say, well, Senator Looney and other people behind this bill, well, they're just trying to make a point. Yeah, but there are some ways you don't make a point. And again, here we have something that it just sounds vindictive. It sounds ghoulish. It's not bad enough they're ghoulish enough on abortion. Hey, everybody in the state can commit an abortion. Come on, let's have those pills on campus. Hey, anybody, including the receptionist, can now perform an abortion. All right. It's not that they're bad enough on that point. Now, I'm laughing here because this has to be a twist of the knife bill, no pun intended. This can't be serious. I'll just read it again. Connecticut Senate President Pro Tem Martin M. Looney has introduced a bill that would automatically assume any motorcyclist killed on the road is an organ donor if they were riding without a helmet. Oh, my God. No surprise, the American Motorcyclists Association expressed outrage and began the fight against the bill, which would presuppose that any street-riding motorcyclist killed would automatically become an organ donor if they were not wearing a helmet. Oh, my God. AMA Government Relations Director Mike Sayers said, quote, the bill shows a callous disregard for the motorcycling public. He's right. Organ donation is a notable cause that regularly saves lives around the country, but the decision to become an organ donor is deeply personal, one that this legislation would take away from the motorcyclist.
He continued, Sayer added, not only is this bill insulting to motorcyclists, but it also violates the religious liberty of those whose faith prohibits posthumous organ donation and is clearly an unconstitutional violation of bodily autonomy for any American. What about when Looney's party gets up there and says, my body, my choice for abortion, right? Well, wait a minute. My body, my choice. Except if it's a motorcyclist who legally decides not to wear a helmet. Boy, I'm telling you. Meantime, we have people that can't pay their electric bills in the state. Meantime, we have, people suggesting that we get rid of the sub-minimum wage for our restaurant workers, and that'll just hike the cost of meals and the cost to restaurant operators. You know, meantime, we have legislators in this state who you have to light a fire under their arse to make them do anything about juvenile crime. But they're worried about the men and women who decide, for whatever reason, under proper Connecticut law, they choose not to wear a motorcycle helmet. When AMA Government Relations Department officials contacted Senator Looney's office, his staff responded that the bill was proposed to help fix declining organ donation rates in Connecticut and dissuade motorcyclists from riding without a helmet. The staffer said their position was that get this, you talk about arrogance. And by the way, if you want to respond to this, I normally don't tell you to call Hartford. I'm going to tell you to call Hartford on this one. Martin Looney's office. This is amazing. The Looney staffer, no pun intended, stated that their position, well, get this, folks, if you're a motorcyclist, whether you have a scooter, a Kawasaki, a Harley, whatever you drive, bullet bike or a nice, Harley cruiser, get this. The staffer in Looney's office stated that their position was that if motorcyclists put their lives at risk riding helmetless, they assume those riders don't care where their organs end up. That came from a high-ranking Democrat, a top Democrat at the state Senate. Again, their position is that if you as a motorcyclist don't want to wear a helmet, then you don't care where your organs end up. Can you be any more callously condescending? And these people don't care. These people don't care. They get elected every 2 years. How do you feel about that? Motorcyclists or not? Rider or not? 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. It is the position, apparently, I'm not misconstruing any of this, it is the position of the state Senate President Pro Tem, longtime Democrat Martin Looney, that if you're killed riding a motorcycle and you don't wear a helmet, that you should, in memoriam, surrender your organs. What happened to you Democrats out there? You listening? What happened to my body, my choice? Oh, that's only when you want an abortion. All right. Carol Platt-Liebau joins us. Carol has joined us plenty of times. She heads the Yankee Institute for Public Policy in Connecticut. Wanted to have Carol on because Carol was among the folks voicing opposition to these traffic enforcement cameras. She testified in New Haven to that the other day. Hey, Carol, it's Paul. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm great, Paul. Good to be with you and your listeners.
And Carol, it finally happened. You and I disagree on something. Well, I don't think I fully disagree.
Oh, Paul, you're going to break my heart. What do we disagree about?
Well, here's the thing, and I read what you said in front of the folks in New Haven, and I can see how these cameras might be construed as an overreach. And I think in an ideal case, we would love to have police officers on every corner, as I said previously before I brought you on today. But let me get to the point here. The point is that we need some sort of enforcement. People are driving like crazy. They're driving, nuts, and there are dangerous intersections. And I don't deny that there is a
sometimes verifiable caution among people to say, hey, is this really about safety or is this just a money scheme? You know what I mean? A money grab here.
I'm
kind of willing to see what they come up with here before I say no to it. But I read what you said the other day, and make your point here, because this is interesting, Carol. This is one of these issues where the right spectrum of the political sphere and the left spectrum, a lot of the traditional liberals, kind of come together on this.
Well, my view is, of course, that we do have a certain right to be free from constant government surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
And if there are problems at selected intersections, there are a lot of ways to address those issues. You can do traffic studies. A lot of the time it has to do with the design. And if there is law breaking, then you need officers to enforce the law. But these red light cameras are another example of the way technology can allow constant government oversight. And, I mean, Paul, we know what we're told. We're told that, you know, it's only going to be at a couple of intersections mm-hmm. that are very dangerous. It doesn't end up being that way. That's like being told that the income tax is only temporary. It never ends up that way. It always comes in, it becomes normalized, and then pretty soon there are traffic cameras on every corner. And it seems to me that that is inconsistent with the way a free country ought to be run. If you need law enforcement officers who are human beings, who are capable of making determinations about what has happened, that's one thing. But, you know, the idea that you can just have red light cameras, there's not a single place, Paul, in the country where these cameras have been installed that any kind of public referendum has come down in favor of them. And that's because some of the people who do like them want to tell us, oh, you know, it keeps racist police people from selective enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, that's a slander on the overwhelming majority of police who are good people. Second of all, if there is that problem, it ought to be fixed. The answer is not having constant camera surveillance on everyone, because, you know, we could bring the number of accidents down to zero.
Mm-hmm.
If we, you know, put monitors in every car, or if we monitored it, every individual, we could probably bring crime way down. But we decide as a free people in a free country that that's not the way we're going to have our public business conducted. And these red light cameras also make mistakes. I know someone personally who in the last few days received a red light or a toll ticket taken by camera, has her license plate, but it's not her car. And then I hear someone else say, oh, good luck getting that fixed. And so most of the time, you know, you can have this kind of arbitrary or erroneous enforcement, and then it's simply too much of a bureaucratic nightmare to correct it. So people just give up, they pay the $75, and again, that isn't the way a free people in a free country ought to be governing themselves. If we have people who are lawbreakers, they ought to be found, but it shouldn't be through a system of constantly surveilling people who are not lawbreakers going about their lawful business.
All right. I agree with probably part, a half or more of what you said. I think the difference I have on this is whether or not there are going to be limits to this. Always good to have Carol Platt-Liebau with us from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, yankeeinstitute.org. And Carol was among the folks that testified in New Haven the other night regarding an aspect of this Vision Zero initiative to maybe allow the state to okay the use of some traffic enforcement cameras in a pilot program. So, Carol, I have to tell you, I do agree with you. I do have a healthy bit of cynicism of saying, you know, the government's going to fix it. That's good. I would be willing in this case to say, well, okay, how is this going to work? all right, you're going to get together with the cities and towns, and the police chiefs are supporting this. It's only going to be at a couple of spots. If you put a sunset date on it, which you and I know never happens, if you put a sunset date on this and you allow the state to make available in an easy-to-look-up form what the data is on this, how fast are these people going, and if this is happening, having any effect, I'm willing to give it a shot, maybe. And I also said yesterday, discussing this, Carol, that, you know, I would mandate that if any city wants to do this, you set up that camera and you tell people for 2 months, okay, we caught you doing 70 in a 40. This would have cost you $400. We're warning you now. But as of 2 months from now, you're going to start getting not warnings, but tickets here. Would any of this dissuade your skepticism, or do you think that there's just kind of no way to do this in a fair way?
Well, Paul, what you're saying, I applaud you, but it seems to me to represent the triumph of hope over experience.
Yeah, I am. I guess I'm just a hopeful guy, Carol.
I mean, I applaud it. I applaud it. It kind of fills my heart with joy to know that there is this kind of hopeful optimism about these cameras being used responsibly. And
yeah.
The other thing is, I do find it mildly creepy that all of a sudden you can just get an anonymous letter saying, "We've been watching. You're doing this. And you'd better stop."
Yeah.
It sounds a little Big Brotherish to me. And I'm not sure that I trust the government with that kind of ongoing surveillance. Now, again, we have these a lot of places,
mm-hmm.
and I understand that. But just because it already exists doesn't mean that it's great to bring in more of it. And I do believe that if in a theoretical world, we could ensure that it was only going to be limited to a few high accident intersections, and that it would not be used as a money grab, and it would truly be used for safety. That's one thing. I'm just not sure how those two desirable ends can ever be guaranteed.
Yeah, and I get you, and I agree with you there. Yeah, I mean, in my support for this, I would say, okay, now state of Connecticut, now cities and towns, here's your chance. And if you blow this, people are just going to throw their hands up in the air and say, see, you know, we told you so. It's interesting. Now, when you gave that testimony the other day, and it was a fascinating article on it, of course, in the New Haven Independent and other spots, how was that received? Because from what I read, Carol, there was a lot of debate on both sides of the issue here.
There was, but I'd like to commend the legislators on both sides. It seemed to me that everyone was granted a respectful hearing. And Representative Lamar, who was conducting the hearing as the chairman from the majority party, I thought treated everyone with great courtesy. And you know, it was the legislative process the way that it's supposed to be conducted, in my view, where you hear from people in the state and you grant everyone a courteous hearing. It's interesting because, you know, the tone of the hearing in general sort of reminded me of the famous phrase, you know, what we aspire to is, you know, we're not enemies. We are fellow citizens trying to do what's best for our state. And I felt very much as though that was the spirit in which the hearing was conducted. And I don't, you know, again, there are very good people with the finest of motives who are proposing this through sheer disinterested concern about the volume of traffic crashes. And I do sympathize with that. I mean, you know, we all know and love people who have been in accidents. It's a terrible thing. It's just the question is, how much are we willing to give up in terms of our personal autonomy and liberty to reach very valuable ends? And can the state be trusted to do what it says it's going to do in terms of limiting its use And, you know, my concern is that the history of that really isn't good. When surveillance like this gets its nose under the tent, it tends to expand. And if you can point to me of a time that the government ever surrendered a power it had taken back to the people, then I would be more optimistic about where this was headed.
And that is the, that's the point a lot of people bring up, is that if you open the door a crack, it never closes. Carol, thank you.
Check out it widens.
Well, yeah, and check out the website, YankeeInstitute.org, YankeeInstitute.org. All the great stuff there, of course, the Inside Investigator section now doing some great journalistic work. Carol Platt-Liebau has been the guest. Carol, thank you. Take care, and we'll chat down the road.
You bet. Always a pleasure, Paul.
Thanks, Carol. Appreciate that. All right, coming up on about 4 years ago, April will make 4 years ago, we started hearing rumblings of a Hunter Biden laptop. And people started to say, oh, yeah, that's one of Joe Biden's son. His other son, Bo, was succumbed to brain cancer a few months earlier. And he said, Hunter Biden laptop. And people would call me up on this show and they'd say, hey, did you hear about that? I said, geez, yeah, but the White House shot it down and it was Russian disinformation. And, well, you know what's happened right now, and word is the information on that laptop is being disseminated in Congress. Did Hunter Biden break any laws? Is the big guy, is that a meaning, is that a connection to his father, Joe Biden? Well, joining us right now, his new book is called American Injustice, My Battle to Expose the Truth. That guy, the computer repairman who was handed the Hunter Biden laptop back in April of 2019, John Paul MacIsaac joins us here on the show. Hey, John Paul, it's Paul here on WICC. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul. Thanks for having me on the show.
So what's the day here? April 12th, 2019, John Paul. Who walks in the door with this laptop? Take us back there.
Well, it was about 10 minutes before closing. Hunter Biden came into the shop with three liquid damage laptops that he wanted the data recovered from. He didn't want them repaired. He just wanted the data recovered. And initially, I thought that it was his deceased brother's laptop, because one of the laptops had a Bo Biden Foundation sticker on it. Mm-hmm. And his brother had passed away about a year and a half, 2 years prior. So I figured this guy was just, he was just like so many of my customers, wanted to get their deceased loved ones' memories off of these devices. It wasn't until the next day during the recovery process that I realized that this was not Bo's laptop. This was Hunter's.
So did you did the name click right away when whatever you had him fill out or taking information from him? Like, you're like, are you related to Mr. Biden? Did that click right away?
You know, once he told me who he was, because I'm visually impaired, mm-hmm. and I did not recognize him. But to be honest, I never really cared to know what the Biden offspring looked like. So yeah. I never really paid much attention to politics or political players or their family members. So when he checked it in at that point in time in early April or mid-April, his father hadn't announced his candidacy. So to me, this was just a guy with a lot of gross stuff on his computer. It wasn't until his father started or announced his candidacy a couple weeks later that I was like, OK, I've seen a lot of embarrassing material. Somebody's going to want to try to sweep this under the carpet, get rid of this laptop. So I made every effort to have Hunter come and pick it up. And by the summer, when it became my property, I just knew I had to get this to the authorities.
So he says to go ahead and do what has happened to a couple of my desktops over the years and thousands of people listening to us. Hey, you know, the fan craps out, or there's water damage, or the screen is busted, or, you know, the power supply doesn't work. Get the data that I have off of these machines and in some way recover it for me. So that's probably a basic job that you've done a few hundred times before, right?
Yep, it's a service I advertised.
Okay, so you go ahead and you recover the data, however you do it, you save it to whatever media Hunter Biden wanted it saved, and you said you saw things on those laptops. What made you go, oh boy, if you did, when you saw some of that stuff? Like, what did you see that made you say, okay, these aren't just beach pictures and memories of mom and dad?
Well, obviously, and it's been covered a lot. There's a lot of embarrassing material on that computer of a very personal nature. And I've never felt it was my place to describe the material or even go into detail. It was gross, and there was a lot, and definitely illegal drug use and illegal sex trade. What I didn't go to the FBI because of a crackhead playing with a gun and making his own homemade porn. I went to the FBI because I saw a lot of money exchanging hands, and we're talking millions of dollars in exchange for access to the highest levels of our government.
American Injustice, My Battle to Expose the Truth, released last November. It's in hardcover. Check it out, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever you get your books, locally or nationally. The guest and the author is John Paul MacIsaac. He, yes, is the computer shop owner and repair person who took in the Hunter Biden laptops. And he saw stuff on there that he says is disturbing, not just from a personal point of view, but from, well, John Paul, explain. We had to cut you off there at the break, but you saw things that you thought were untawdry as far as access buying, as far as emails and things like that. So you see that. What makes you go to the feds? What made you contact somebody about this?
Well, I went for multiple reasons. The first reason was obviously I needed some level of protection. I was sitting on a time bomb, and I knew that this was criminality that had to be handed over to the authorities, but I also feared retribution and retaliation. So I wanted some level of personal protection. I also wanted, you know, obviously people held accountable. There was a pay-for-play scheme running out of the office of the vice presidency, and that's just not how that's not what we elect these people to do. And then also by the time September of 2019 rolled around, I realized I was sitting on evidence that would exonerate the president's impeachment hearings that were taking place. So there was three main reasons to get this to the authorities. Now, I didn't trust the FBI. I believed in the system. I still do. I think that it has its purpose. But I didn't trust them, so I made a backup of the laptop.
What was your next contact, though? You said you didn't trust the FBI, but did you go to the FBI? Did you retain counsel? What did you do to move this piece on the chessboard here, knowing you wanted to protect yourself, but saying that you were sitting on something that your gut told you was pretty big?
So I really love my business. I had my shop for 10 years. It's about 10 miles from Joe's house. I knew that if word got out of what my activity or what I was doing and what I was up to trying to get this to the authorities, I would be ruined. So I sent my father, who's a retired colonel in the Air Force, out to Albuquerque, where they live, to visit the FBI with a copy of the drive and a copy of the paperwork and basically say, look, get my son some level of protection. Here's the criminality. Act on it. He's out in Delaware. I'm out in New Mexico. I can't do anything to help him. Please help my son. He's never asked his government for anything in his life. He gave the Air Force 31 years, and the FBI told him to not talk about these things. Lawyer up. Get out of their office. And it was my father described it as the most humiliating experience of his life.
So then what was your next or further contact, John Paul, with the FBI? What was your encounter like, and what did they say?
Well, we didn't hear anything after that for about a month, and then an FBI agent reached out to my father in an effort to get a hold of me. I agreed to meet with the agent. They showed up to my home about mid-November. I once again tried to give the two agents a copy of the laptop, tried to show them documents pertaining to Burisma that I felt were relevant to the impeachment hearings, and they once again ignored it. They said that they couldn't take the laptop, they'd have to talk to their legal team, and they'd get back to me. Eventually, they showed up to my shop on December 9th with a subpoena. I don't think they had ever handed someone a subpoena that was so excited to receive one. I was delighted because I was getting everything I wanted. The laptop was getting out of, finally leaving my shop, and they were taking it. And so I gave it to them, and when they were leaving, I cracked a joke and said, "Don't worry, lads. When I write the book, I'll leave your names out."
Did you really? What did they say? What did they say? Did they laugh?
Well, Agent Mike turned around and told me that in his experience, nothing ever happens to people that don't talk about these things.
Oh, how about that? So then we fast forward a little more here, Jean-Paul, and Jean-Paul Mac Isaac is the guest, American Injustice, My Battle to Expose the Truth. Yes, we're talking to the computer repair person, the tech, who was handed the Hunter Biden laptops. So then word of this kind of starts to trickle out. It's being called Russian disinformation by Jen Psaki and certain members of Congress. Twitter gets slammed because you couldn't share a New York Post story on this. So let's fast forward a bit. Were you contacted by any other legal people, members of Congress, the media? What was the next step in this, John Paul?
Well, after the impeachment trial, and I realized that not only did the FBI had absolutely no plans on admitting this laptop as evidence, they definitely didn't care about acting on the criminality. If anything, they cared more about protecting the Bidens than they did of ever protecting me. So I sent my father and my uncle to reach out to members of Congress over the late winter and spring and early summer of 2020. Unfortunately, with the height of the pandemic and I believe Congress paralyzed by the fear of being caught up in more Russian disinformation. And as we are starting to find out, there was an actual effort by the FBI to warn members of Congress to be prepared for people reaching out to them about this laptop. And it's scary because there was this collusion that we had no idea existed until Elon Musk released the Twitter files. So I'm grateful for that. It was finally in August. I was so frustrated that nothing was going to get done that I traded my fear for courage. And I reached out to a lawyer for the president of the United States named Rudy Giuliani, reached out to his office, spoke to a lawyer for him, never spoke to Rudy. Mm-hmm. Never wanted Rudy to even know who I was. I was still convinced that I could do the right thing and get away with it. Unfortunately, I mailed them a copy of the drive on August 28th. New York Post ran the story on October 14th, and it took about 30 minutes for people to connect the dots. I started receiving death threats, and I was basically about 2 weeks, 3 weeks later, forced out of town, forced to close my shop, and I went into exile for about a year.
A few more minutes with our guest, the author of American Injustice, My Battle to Expose the Truth, Jean-Paul Mac Isaac. Yes, he is the guy that was running that computer repair shop where Hunter Biden came in back on April 12th of 2019 and said, here are some laptops. Can you please recover the data here? Jean-Paul saw the data. He kept copies of it, eventually was able to get it to some people who cared. Jean-Paul, who eventually started the motion on this that maybe made you happy here, saying at least this is going to move up the chain here? Was it a congressional staffer? Was it a member of Congress? Was it a media person? How did we get to the next step here?
Well, so honestly, the first person or the first group of people that showed any interest in what I had, truly showed interest and were willing to act on it, was Rudy Giuliani's group and his lawyer, Bob Costello. And I thought my involvement at that point in time was over. Unfortunately, when I started getting labeled as a Russian agent and a hacker, and I had to defend myself, I was definitely hoping that I would have members of Congress that I tried to reach out to mm-hmm. rush to my aid. Unfortunately, I was left on my own for the better part of a year. Mm-hmm. I think that now that the laptop's been verified by multiple sources, it's come back. I think that people are being more receptive. I've been working with multiple groups in Congress over the last 6 months to make sure they have all the resources, the timeline. I wrote the book so that history would have the cliff notes to the whole chain of custody, how that laptop came to be. And I've fought tooth and nail to preserve the integrity of the drive, because there's been multiple attempts out there for people to try to influence or change the data or muddy the waters. So this has been a constant battle for me, and I'm very delighted that members of Congress, two groups in specific, Comer's group and Jordan's group, have shown a lot of interest, and I'm looking forward to testifying and hopefully closing this chapter to my life and moving on.
Yeah, that was going to be my last question here, Jean-Paul. Will we see you on national television testifying anytime soon and answering questions about this?
Well, I had one condition, and that was that I get to wear my kilt. So I want to prove to the world that that I'm not a Russian, that, you know, that if they had said that Scotland was trying to interfere with the course of an election, then maybe that would be believable. So I want to hold these people accountable. I'd love to do it in person. Obviously, security is really high for me right now, so I'm not leaving the house. I don't really go anywhere. So, you know, we'll see. It's up to Congress. If they want me to testify, I'd be delighted to show Adam Schiff what a non-Russian individual looks like.
And thankfully, you're keeping at least some modicum of your sense of humor through this, which is admirable. The name of the book, American Injustice, My Battle to Expose the Truth, John Paul Mac Isaac, the author. Pick it up, download it, audiobook, read it, decide for yourself, folks. John Paul, thanks. We appreciate it. I have your contacts number, so we'll stay in touch. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you, and thank you for all the people that have shown me support. It keeps me going.
Thanks, John Paul. Appreciate it. Take care.
Cheers.
There you go. All right, folks. So maybe we will see him testifying in front of Congress. Who knows? Interesting scenario, though. So I guess it wasn't Russian disinformation, I guess.